Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
And you're listening to Off the Hour here on CKUT 90.3 FM. And today we have a special broadcast. We have two members of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty who work specifically with immigrant and refugee cases in the province of Ontario. And we will be discussing new anti-terrorism laws post-September 11th, Bill C-35, C-36, and C-42, and how they affect immigrants and refugees in Canada. So we are inviting people to call into the studio today to pose their questions concerning this topic. The number in studio is 514-398-4616. We'll be back in a moment after some music.
Ontario, we have a premier who says, I don't do protests. I don't do anything that these special interest groups say that I should do. I don't give a shit if you put 250,000 people on the front lawn of the legislature. It means shit. Because the people who live and the people who die in the street are considered to be a special interest group. Now, when we're told that, And the question's been raised about mass movement and the mass mobilization of people. If you can mobilize every person in the province of Ontario, it doesn't mean that there isn't going to be 75 people die in the streets of Toronto this winter. It doesn't mean that. So when we're confronted by a government that chooses not to respond in any way to public pressure that's through the normal course of the process, then as an advocate and as a participant in that process, you have to examine how far am I willing to go?
And you're listening to Off the Hour here on CKUT 90.3 FM. And we're in studio with two members of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty who are here to discuss the effects of post-September 11th anti-terrorism legislature on immigrant and refugees in Canada. And, okay, could you guys give a brief introduction about the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty and specific cases that you've been working on post-September 11th?
Okay, maybe just starting with what OCAP is. We are an anti-poverty group based primarily in Toronto, and we've been around for about 11 years. And over the course of the work that we've done, sort of naturally, we've gotten into dealing directly with immigration issues because naturally that's something that people need to come to us for, and increasingly people have over the last 4 years. We've done direct action casework with over 50 families. And so currently we have about 7 or 8 cases on the go. And some of them have been directly impacted by the September 11th bombings. Maybe just as an example, the situation right now, because legislation hasn't completely been brought into practice, we're witnessing some of the precursors to that legislation and some of the basic changes in attitudes informally amongst immigration staff and how they're informally treating different applicants. So, for example, we have a Muslim family originally from Kenya that we're working with right now, And they were supposed to be interviewed in order for their application for landing to be adjudicated 3 days after the bombing, okay, and were forced to cancel that interview and are now scrambling to be able to present themselves in such a way that they are not automatically going to be cast aside by people within immigration who are now putting very, very strong boundaries against particularly Muslim men,
okay,
gaining landed status in Canada. Yeah.
And that was actually, we received a question during the first couple moments of the show here, asking specifically how new anti-terrorism legislature is going to affect Caribbean and African communities in Canada. So maybe expand a bit on that case and also on the different cases that you've been working on.
Well, for that case specifically, yeah. I mean, you have a situation where even though those laws have not been brought into effect as of yet, and though they have been declared laws, you have a situation of people scrambling because we know the tremendous power of immigration officers individually to pick and choose who they're going to land and who they're not going to land. So already you have a situation where there are major crackdowns on people from the Caribbean specifically that we know of and have worked with, and that Steph can speak better to than I can because it's a case that she's specifically working on, but of people who are being processed for deportation with incredible speed and immigration thwarting their normal rules of practice in order to get people out of the country before they even have the ability to properly appeal their cases. And Steph could expound upon that further.
Yeah, one of the changes that's coming down is sort of an overhaul of what our border, the one that we share with the U.S., means. And one part of the changes is changes in visa requirements. And there's eight countries that have already had that see those changes. And one of them is Grenada, an island in the Caribbean. And what that's going to mean, or what that does mean, is that the government is attempting to stem a flow of migrant workers who come seeking better opportunity and you know, work and a chance to survive, before, you know, stopping that process before it even starts, before people even start to get their lives going here in Canada. And the case that Sarah was referring to is a woman from Grenada who has been in Canada for 5 years. She's got a Canadian-born daughter and a spouse that she lives with here. And she overstayed a visa. And normally in a situation like that, once immigration finds out that you're here without proper documents, you're given written notice that you're to meet with them and that they will make arrangements for your removal. But in Brenda's situation, immigration went straight to her house looking for her with a warrant. And not finding her there, instead picked up her babysitter, who is also from Grenada. And this is a young woman named Shirley Ann who's lived here since she was 13 or 14, more than a decade. And she was arrested, detained at the detention center in Toronto, and within about 10 days sent back to Grenada without, you know, the usual multiple opportunities to plead her case, tell her story. So like Sarah was saying, things already seem to be moving a lot faster, and that's, you know, hitting like a whole range of communities, not necessarily just Arabic or Muslim communities at all.
Specifically on this case, what has the reaction been in Toronto or also outside of Toronto, in that how have you guys publicized these realities, and how has the public responded?
We've taken the approach that people should be aware that the new legislation that's coming down is albeit targeted, is just sort of stepping up the racism and economic discrimination that already existed and was already entrenched in the immigration system. And so, you know, drawing people's attention to a case like Brenda's or any of the other cases that we're working on right now is sort of a heads up that this kind of hunt for undocumented peoples in Canada has always existed, but you know, there's definitely a stepping up of that sweep and of an attempt to, you know, clean out sort of people that the Canadian government doesn't feel fit some ideal economic or racial demographic. So, through contacts in unions and through our, website, et cetera, the stories are being made public. But as far as action is concerned, we're following the same steps that, OCAP typically does when working on cases. And Sarah, maybe want to elaborate on how that usually goes.
Yeah, our usual process on working on cases that come to us, and it's been very, very successful in the past, is to begin by ensuring that people have the strongest possible legal application that they can file and are making every argument that they can make on their own behalf, and then to bolster that by adding in a direct action component and a advocacy type of component, in which if the family feels that it's appropriate in their situation, and generally families are all for it, then we will target the enforcement center with direct actions in order to stop their deportation, and we will take action and gather letters of support and gather media, if possible, around their cases in order to push for them to be granted landing in Canada. And one of the things, too, that post-September 11th, especially, that we're looking to do and have started on is working with contacts in other cities to make sure that we are able to put maximum amounts of pressure on immigration. And so we have just recently been meeting with a variety of groups in Montreal that have agreed in principle to work with us around cases and around broader immigration issues, so that we're targeting everywhere we can possibly target, particularly because the cabinet has just been shuffled, and so you now have the immigration minister right here in Montreal, Denis Coderre.
Okay. And I guess another question would be, OCAP historically, as you have both mentioned, has involved itself in direct action pertaining to casework or pertaining to other issues, homelessness and poverty. Now, in the situation of post-September 11th legislature, how have people responded to direct action type of situations? And also, could you perhaps elaborate a little bit more on your immigration campaign that OCAP is working on with ties to Montreal organizations?
Okay, maybe for the first part of the question, which I can't exactly remember. Sorry.
How have people responded to direct action type ideas in terms of dealing with specific cases?
Well, in some ways it's a bit too early to say. What we do know, unfortunately, is that we know that the disruption at the office level is something that immigration simply can't deal with because they are far too backlogged right now. So for them, oftentimes passing an individual case is more in their interests than dealing with constant disruption of their offices. So that's how we've been successful in the past. And that basic principle hasn't changed, although we expect that they will be quicker to call police, they will be quicker to crack down on us. But the big change that we've seen already is that a lot of activist groups and union-type groups are very reticent to take action right now in post-September 11th climate. And without actually having physically been cracked down upon yet, they are assuming that they will be cracked down on. So we're not getting the kind of support that we need and that the families need in order to do the actions that they need to take in order to stay in the country.
I think one of the things that we've sort of been talking about amongst ourselves and are urging people to think about is that although this legislation is very serious and is already starting to have very serious effects, in terms of the activist community, organizers and activists in the United States have been dealing with grand jury type situations where people are arrested without evidence, not given a lot of options in terms of getting out of jail or going to court. That's been a reality for a very long time, much as the treatment of political prisoners and the denial of rights of people in jail has been a longstanding reality there. And that hasn't stopped people from fighting, and it's certainly there's no excuse to not keep pushing the envelope, at least until we find out where the limits lie, and that's the approach that we're taking.
Okay. We're going to take a short break.
whole issues of casework. And I heard it talked about that the difficulty between bringing casework in as an organization and dealing with it, and at the same time fighting back. I don't believe that the two can be separated. In OCAP, we not only deal with welfare cases, immigration cases, we deal with disability, we deal with unemployment insurance, we deal with workers' compensation, we deal with criminal charges, we deal with provincial offenses when people are charged with trespassing for squatting in a building. Those are things that we started a campaign to get every ticket, every criminal charge that the cops in downtown Toronto lay against homeless people. And since we started that, we've gotten 700 or 800 cases, up to 1,000 cases with under the new Safe Streets Act. They've had to open 3 new courtrooms in only to deal with our.
We're in studio with two members of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty to discuss the realities facing people who want to immigrate to Canada or claim refugee status post September 11th, and we did receive a call a minute ago about how do people plug into these this kind of information here in Montreal. And there's an event happening tonight at the Cégep de Vaux Montréal, which is at 255 Ontario East. It's at 7 p.m. and it's a panel discussion with a number of there's a number of organizations. There's going to be representation from the Collective Opposed to Police Brutality, the Immigrant Workers Center of Montreal, Quebec Legal Collective, which formed for the FTA protests in Quebec City, and also two representatives of OCAP who will be talking about immigration. So we're going to now maybe just take a short overview of the campaign which has been being worked on by OCAP concerning immigrants and refugees in Canada post September 11th.
Yeah, like Sarah was saying, the aim is to hit immigration on as many fronts as possible. And what we're looking to do with groups in Vancouver, Ottawa, Montreal, and Toronto is to launch a larger scale campaign that has three basic demands. And they're very straightforward demands that will allow groups in all of these cities to sort of approach immigration with their own particular local slant. The three demands are that all prisoners who are being held without criminal charges, all detainees being held without criminal charges post September 11th, be immediately released. For those that have been criminally charged, we're asking, demanding that they be given access to full legal counsel as well as to their families, and that they get a chance to have speedy trial, et cetera, that the process move ahead as it should, as opposed to being shrouded in the mystery that it has been so far. And the second and third demands center around the Afghani refugee crisis. And it's important to remember that Afghani refugees in Canada have long faced very serious delays. There's one major visa office in the Middle East, and that's in Islamabad. There's also one in Tehran in Iran. But the process has been grinding for refugees that are here already, 3 to 5 year wait. And that obviously is a lot more serious now. People know that, hundreds of thousands of Afghani refugees have been fleeing the country and flooding into nations surrounding Afghanistan, and some of them are not even able to get across the borders. And the Canadian government and Immigration Canada they closed their office immediately following the attacks, and then reopened it but did nothing to sort of bolster the staff there. So you can imagine that an already backlogged office is, so much more so now. So we're asking, demanding that the staffing in those offices be increased, and also that a program be instigated similar to the one that centered around Kosovo refugees during the NATO strikes, because it's a life and death situation if people are being forced to wait years to not only get their landed status here, but then to begin the sponsorship process for families that are overseas. So those are are very sort of straightforward, pertinent demands to the time as it is now. But that isn't to say that, you know, groups working in various cities across the country aren't going to take their own slant, much as we will as well, attaching particular cases onto the campaign to make it that much more personal and that much stronger.
We did receive a question during the last musical break, which was concerning Muslim families or people around the world. Should Muslims from other places consider moving to Canada or the United States post September 11th? And what would Muslims encounter trying to immigrate to Canada post September 11th?
Well, I think short answer, yes, definitely. The reality is there are tremendous numbers of people, Muslim and not Muslim, who desperately need, for economic and political reasons, to leave their country of origin. And Canada, still relatively speaking, is one of the best, if not the best, country in terms of immigration policy, which is sad to say, but is the truth. And part of the propaganda that's currently being circulated and the fear-mongering that's increasing around these issues is in order to dissuade people from immigrating to Canada or to the United States in the first place. It's basically Muslim people, people of color, poor people are not wanted by the Canadian and the U.S. governments. And if they can be dissuaded purely by the reputation of those countries' immigration policies, so much the better. That's clearly in their interests. But that shouldn't dissuade people from seeking the protections that they can still gain in those countries. Now, like, words of caution, of course, the process is difficult. If you arrive in Canada, you should seek out legal and political assistance as soon as you possibly can, because you will encounter a number of different roadblocks. And I mean, people should expect to encounter what they've always encountered in these countries, and that's racism, that's economic discrimination, that's a basic attitude that if they can find a way to block your access to gaining refugee status or gaining permanent status in this country, they will block that access, and they will certainly block your access to bringing over family members from your country of origin as well. So, I mean, the legal options still exist for people to do those things. Canada has not reversed all of its laws. There still is a quota of immigrants and refugees that are supposed to be accepted within Canada. And I would strongly urge people to, yes, to be wary, yes, to be politically aware, but to use those opportunities that are presented to them to the best of their ability, and to seek the political support in order to make sure that they are backed up and that they can't be isolated and that they can't be turned back because of bias and discrimination and racism within the system.
I guess perhaps you might want to address the issue of another caller about ways that you can find out more information about these realities.
Well, yeah, this caller was strongly agreeing with what we were talking about in terms of, you know, the difficulties of resisting. And, you know, it's been difficult to resist for a very long time, but that's no excuse for people to not step up this fight, especially at this time. There's more reason than ever. And his concern was, you know, what do I do here in Montreal? Where do I go? Who is taking up this struggle here? And Sarah and I have been very encouraged by our brief stay in Montreal because of the people we've been lucky enough to meet with, people out of the Immigrant Workers Center, people who work with PNAI, very strongly organized Filipino community, as well as people from CLAC and Anti-Racist Action, and people who are doing very solid Argentinian, Latin American solidarity work. And you did announce the panel that's happening tonight, and that's one option. But, you know, places like the Immigrant Workers Center and, you know, just the communities that we're talking about, that, like, if you're wanting to tap in, then pay attention and keep your ears open for the very solid plans that those organizations I mentioned are looking to carry out. It really feels like there's going to be a strong wave of response and resistance to, you know, the reality of Immigration Canada as it is today. And as Sarah said as well, there has been a fortunate cabinet shuffle, some might say, and the former Minister of Sport is now the Minister of Immigration, and his riding sits right here. So
it's definitely something to focus on. Okay, we're going to go to a little bit of more music here on CKUT, and we'll be back in a moment. Again, we're in studio with two members of the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. We're taking phone calls concerning the realities facing immigrants and refugees here in Canada post-September 11th. We just had an interesting caller who heard what we've been talking about the last half an hour and came to the conclusion that OCAP has very much a defensive role against new anti-terrorism legislature. The caller wanted to know, what is OCAP's offensive role?
Yeah, I think it's a good question in the sense that it points to an obvious absence of a plan that needs to, but that organizations throughout Canada need to have vis-a-vis immigration, and more broadly and politically speaking, people who are left-leaning tend to operate from a defensive position as opposed to an offensive one. And the reality of our situation is, I think OCAP tends to try to come at things from a very pragmatic point of view. So we assess the amount of power that we have and the amount of power that our on-the-ground allies have, and then we operate from that. How much can we gain based on that level of power? And the situation that we're in right now is that if we are to be frank about it, and if we are to engage in campaigns that we believe we can actually be successful in, then we are forced to operate from, to some degree, a defensive position. So part of this laying the groundwork across Canada and getting commitments from different organizations to bolster that defensive strategy is that when we have been able to work successfully together and lay some of that groundwork, hopefully in the future we can move to a more offensive strategy. But for us to engage in an offensive strategy right now would be to engage in something that ideologically is interesting. It's something that we agree with, but rationally and in terms of the amount of power that we have, it would be engaging in something that is very much symbolic. And we don't have time for a solely symbolic argument. We have people that we're dealing with right now who are facing very real situations of literally life and death.
Okay. And again, the number to call for any questions is 514-398-4616. Do you like to illustrate on that at all?
Well, the second part of that caller's question was asking about whether or not OCAP has ties with a fairly prominent movement in Europe, which is calling for the eradication of borders. There's a whole network of groups that do work around illegals, in quotation marks, asylum seekers. And the reality in Europe is different than, you know, the North American continent. And I think that OCAP is working on a premise that addresses that, which is why we're trying to build a very strong national network at first. I mean, Europe is a much smaller landmass with countless numbers of borders, and its proximity to Africa and its proximity to the Middle East does make for, you know, different points of entry into nations. The reality that there are huge refugee camps set up on borders within European nations, like, that's just something that we don't see here. So I think while, you know, ideologically we definitely want to keep the lines of communication open with groups that have started and, you know, sporadically do contact us from Europe, I think we're really seeking to address this. The reality here is we share the longest border in the world with the United States. And we do and are working with groups in the U.S. for sure. And, you know, are hoping that similar links will occur with Mexico as well, with groups in Mexico, because of the influx of migrant workers from Mexico as well. So it's for sure something that we sort of keep an eye on, but also bearing in mind that, you know, the way that asylum seekers come into Canada is quite different than the way human traffic flows on the European continent.
Okay. Maybe that's a point to illustrate on, actually, the relationship between the anti-terrorism laws in Canada and the United States and how the two countries have operated kind of intermingling after September 11th.
Well, yeah, people will probably be aware that the United States has passed a Patriot Act, and that's, you know, along very similar lines as bills C-35, 36, and 42 here in Canada. There are a lot of similarities. There is a major push, like I said before, to harmonize immigration policy and enforcement with the United States. So, say, for instance, before, you used to be able to bounce through the United States and claim refugee status or file a claim in Canada or vice versa, and the ability to do that is now going to be eliminated. Likewise, there's going to be information sharing and a harmonized enforcement team working on the borders. Information sharing in terms of, you know, passengers on flights and the disclosure of that information to customs officials. And also, there are so many, you know, parallels in terms of the way that the Canadian government, well, the Canadian government is shadowing the American government in a lot of respects in terms of detaining Arabs, people from Arabic countries of Muslim descent. Disappearances are happening in the United States and Canada. And another important thing that is going to change for Canadian legislation is that immigration never used to be able to detain people upon point of entry, or didn't make a practice of detaining people on point of entry if they didn't have proper documentation. And that's a very real change that falls under Bill C-36. Now, if you come, say, with improper documents, and people from war-torn countries face that reality all the time. There's no established government. There's nowhere to, you know, get a proper passport, etc. And you come into Canada however you can with whatever papers you can, and that used to not be grounds for automatic detention, and that's something that's changed.
That also is going to have a tremendous impact on refugees coming into this country because, like Steph was saying, there's a huge, huge number of people who don't have proper documentation, who couldn't possibly have it. And the irony here, and one of the things that I'm sure the Canadian government is very much aware of, is that they place people into a position where they must have fake documentation to get into this country. And they've been doing this with Somali people, for instance, for a long time as well. But what they do is they put such an onus on people to produce documentation that they that the Canadian government knows that they cannot possibly have access to. So you buy fake documentation, you turn it over to Immigration Canada, and then they say, oh, well, this person's a criminal. I'm not going to allow them status in this country. And again, that's a tie-in as well, because for years that's been happening, and we've had many cases of families that have been charged with that exact thing prior to this legislation. And in terms of enforcement and the amount of people detained, it's going to have a huge, huge impact. The other thing as well is once you are able to detain a family, your ability to take away their political power and take away their rights to appeal is also bolstered. In Toronto, for instance, I know that we don't have a lot of time, but I want to talk about this briefly because it's really important. The Celebrity Inn is the family detention center in Toronto. They have a practice, an informal practice, in which they cut out people's legal opportunity to an appeal. Once you are ordered deported, you cannot appeal that deportation to the federal court until you have an actual deportation date. So what the Celebrity Inn does is that they simply never give people a date of deportation. Therefore, they can never appeal it. They can never legally stop their deportation. They simply remove families in the night, take them to the airport, and deport them automatically. You never have legal opportunity to go to the federal court. And I guarantee that with this new aspect of legislation, you will see that happening increasingly.
Can visit the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty on the web at www.ocap.ca. We'll be back in a moment.
Realizes that we live in a state that is a participant in the globalization movement. We live in a state that chooses to target, attack, exploit working and poor people simply for the fact that we are not profit-generating citizens.
We're taking questions about post-September 11th realities facing immigrants and refugees in Canada, or people attempting to apply for refugee or immigrant status in Canada. So we have time for a couple more phone calls. You can call 514-398-4616. So we'll just jump into a question that was posted.
We had a very specific question regarding someone's immigration situation, and I would encourage that person to come out tonight so that we can speak personally and get all of the details about the case. And this event is happening at 7 o'clock tonight at Cégep de Vieux-Montréal in the Cafeteria des Non-Fumeurs. So that's 7 o'clock tonight. So come on out and we will be happy to speak with you directly. The question briefly was that this woman, her daughter was living in Canada. She has a spouse here. She has two children here. She's originally from Trinidad. She her husband filed what I'm assuming would have to be a humanitarian and compassionate application for her to remain in Canada and receive her landing, and attached a spousal sponsorship to it. She returned to Trinidad 2 months ago to visit with family. Immigration found out and is now saying that she has to start the application process all over again, which means $500 application fee down the drain, including as well as all the legal costs that she probably had to pay, and also means that she would be out of the country probably for at least a year. That's actually optimistic, while her children are in Canada. So the broad answer, not knowing the exact specifics of the case, would be that if she has filed a humanitarian compassionate application, Immigration Canada has a legal obligation to process it whether or not she is in the country. That is not true. And she may need some support to force Immigration to adhere to its policies, but that is what it's legally obligated to do. She can try to come back in the meantime. There's no visa requirement from Trinidad. In terms of getting back into the country, ID-wise, it might be difficult for her. If she has enough money, she can weigh that as an option. But it would be in her interest to have the application she's already made processed rather than attempt to go through an all-new application process, which would be a spousal sponsorship from Trinidad and would involve a much longer wait period and a whole new series of costs associated with that. But again, I strongly urge you to come out so we can speak in person tonight.
I guess we could go into now. What do we see for the future in terms of... in terms of this campaign that OCAP is involved with in Ontario and Quebec, and also in terms of the anti-terrorism legislature, where do you guys see this as going in the future when these laws are passed? What kind of society do you think will result of this situation? It's a broad question, but go ahead.
Well, I think first off, in terms of where this campaign is going, working around the disappearances that have happened here in Canada, as well as, you know, the ones that we've read much more about in the United States, is a very concrete first step. It's addressing the fact that the government is not being held accountable to us, that we actually don't have any clear idea of how many people are being detained in such a manner, unjustifiably. Excuse me. And also that in pushing for accountability this way, we're hoping to sort of increase public awareness of the reality of detention centers that are scattered across the nation right now. Like we were talking about before, the powers to detain upon entry into Canada are going to hit people really hard, and we're just sort of starting to get news now of families being detained. We know of for sure 5 families of Pakistani descent that have been detained trying to come into Canada through Montreal, and there's no doubt that there are other families in the same situation. And if you know if you're in that situation and you're not being given access to lawyers and you know nobody knows your whereabouts, you're pretty stuck. So one of the sort of very concrete things that organizations and people that are seeking to act can do is to demand answers around that very serious situation right away. So I think that that's probably the most concrete sort of first step in this longer-term campaign, as well as really strengthening the network of organizations that do this kind of work, because it is very common for groups that take on casework like this to feel very isolated and to feel, overwhelmed by the legal and logistical details that are involved in winning cases. And if we, you know, can start to expand the network and feel as if there is, you know, a whole ream of people and groups from all different communities working on this stuff, then I think it's only gonna strengthen the fight.
Yeah, let's focus for a second on the point of isolation, both in terms of organizations working on these issues, but also in terms of individuals. How do you feel the new anti-terrorism legislature, also existing immigrant and refugee legislature, how do you feel it affects individual cases in terms of isolation? Do you find often when you encounter cases that people feel isolated and feel as if, you know, they're kind of in a bottomless pit and they don't know where to go for help?
Yeah, it very much depends what community a person is coming from. There are some communities that are very strong, very much united, where people have a lot of community support. But we've worked with, I can only say from our experience, but we've worked with immigrants and refugees from a large number of different countries. And generally speaking, people tend to be very isolated and feel very much that the persecution that they're facing from the Canadian government is personalized against them. It's not a political phenomenon. It's something that, for some reason, somebody has decided that they're just not going to get in, and there's roadblock after roadblock after roadblock. And I think it's no accident that people tend to view their situation in a way that's very much depoliticized, and it's very much as an individual case and then in an isolated sort of fashion. And as soon as you start breaking through some of that isolation and people start realizing this is not because I happen to get a bad immigration officer, this is because it is a uniform, undeclared policy of the Canadian government to exclude certain groups of people, and I'm facing the brunt of that, then you have the beginnings of where people can start coming together and fighting around these issues.
And how do you feel the isolation people feel in specific cases in terms of immigration and refugees applications? How do you feel that isolation illustrates the situation in a broader context of Canadian society and in terms of other, not just in terms of welfare, in terms of homelessness, and also people in general?
Well, I think Canadian society in general, people tend to be highly depoliticized. People tend to be very poorly educated. If you look at internationally how well educated and what kind of sense of history people have internationally, Canada is definitely at the lower end of political consciousness. And, you know, you see that playing out in all sorts of different realms where people are systematically convinced that they live in a liberal democracy that has their best interests at heart, and if they have failed in some way, if they have been unable to gain access to certain things, it's either because they're personally flawed or it's because they have somehow fallen through the cracks of an otherwise, you know, decent system, which is, of course, not the case. And that that kind of reputation, that kind of attitude is used in order to continually isolate people, reinforce a sense of individualism, reinforce a sense that there is nothing they can do but individually try harder, which is, of course, the absolute wrong approach for us to be taking. The approach has to be that we recognize these as political and systemic issues and that we have to fight them as a unified force.
Thank you for everybody who called in today. You've been listening to Off the Hour here on CKUT.